Also, it's a very special day for us, a special day for God's church in many of his congregations where the blessing of children ceremony is taking place. It's heartwarming, and it's encouraging for the whole congregation, and it's a very special moment. There are provisions in the guidelines that the church has provided for this day that allow us to also have a ceremony outside of the regular church service in the event that a family is not able to be here for the service itself. So I'll just mention that a week from tomorrow, my wife and I will be visiting with Eric and Rachel Greger, and we will have the opportunity to have some of his family there with us as well, Eric's family, to share in a blessing ceremony for little Julie. I thought it was especially interesting and encouraging. Eric, of course, has not come to services with us, but he's very friendly toward the church. And he mentioned to his parents that we were going to have this special ceremony for their granddaughter, and they were very interested, and they want to be there as well. And so I think that's a very special touch, a very special thing for Eric and Rachel to be able to share that with his parents, and also Rachel's sister, Rebecca, and her husband, Chris, will be there as well. So it'll be a little private family ceremony, but we will have the privilege of being able to bless Julie as well. And hopefully Rachel and Julie will be able to come by and to begin to attend services with us. I know that we're all anxious to get to know Julie as well. It reminds us that, you know, we are a church family, and a family is made up of multiple generations. And as we gather together on the Sabbath, we do so as a family, from our youngest ones to our senior members. God has put us all in this very special place together. The family, of course, is the building block of society. Family is universal throughout cultures and ages and very different circumstances. The family, I think, is one of those things that evolutionists have no convincing explanation for. Why do humans live in families? We don't live in a flock. We don't live in a herd. We don't live in a litter or a gaggle. As far as evolutionists are concerned, we're just animals. We're just a little further up the chain of development. But somehow, humans ended up living as families. Well, I don't know that they have an explanation for that, but we understand very clearly. We know from Genesis 2 that the family is a fundamental part of God's creation. When God instituted marriage and family, he said that one man should marry one woman, and they would start their own household, and that their children would grow up, and they themselves would marry. So he began this cycle of life based on the family. I wonder sometimes, we don't have very much detail in the book of Genesis, but when God created Adam and Eve and brought them together, he must have taken some time to explain to them who they were and what was happening here, to let them know what it means to be a husband and a wife, and to give them some instruction on how they would put their lives together. We don't know in Scripture, in the history in Genesis, just how that information or knowledge was passed to them. As time passed, God expanded the knowledge of and the instruction about marriage to others as well. By the time Israel was born as a nation, there were some very specific laws regarding marriage. For example, God prohibited the marriage of close relatives. And two of the commandments that he gave specifically protect the family. Number five, to honor your father and mother, certainly perpetuates the connection and the role of parents and their children together. And obviously, number seven, you shall not commit adultery, is a direct and specific protection of the marriage and of the family. There are many other scriptural principles or laws that govern marriage and family. And we understand that when we live within those principles, we can have happy, peaceful, and stable families. And if we don't, there will be negative results. And that sometimes those negative results can carry on through generations. Now, when I speak on this subject, I know that for some it's a pretty sensitive one. Obviously, not all of us in the congregation currently live in a traditional family circumstance. Some have lost their spouse, either through the painful experience of death or divorce. When that happens, of course, there are sometimes our single parents, fathers and mothers, raising children without a spouse. A different kind of a family. That can be done successfully, although there are, of course, extra challenges. And obviously, we have some with us in our congregation who have not ever been married. So I know that we're reaching out to a whole diverse group of people in different kinds of circumstances. I'll take a moment to be candid with you as well. When I've spoken on this topic, I've always felt a little bit uneasy. Because when I finish this message today, I have to go home and face my wife. That's not a bad thing. But I realize, you know, even though our marriage is solid and secure, when I speak on the topic of marriage and on family, it may sound like I'm up here giving you all the answers and I'm telling you everything you need to know on this subject. But please understand, I'm well aware that I'm preaching to myself just as much or more as to anyone else. Family and marriage are a great blessing and a great privilege for us to be able to enjoy, but it also creates a challenge for us in our lives. Marriage and family provide us with an opportunity for personal growth and also for us to be able to help others who are in our marriage and family in their growth. My general point today is that regardless of our immediate circumstances, we're all part of a family. And one purpose of our family is to help us to prepare for our eternal and spiritual family. The title I've given to the sermon this afternoon is Basic Principles of Marriage and Family. It's good for us to review and to confirm in our lives that there is responsibility as well as opportunity that comes from our family circumstances. And there are principles that we can apply that will help us to grow even in marriages that are already healthy and happy. Even though family remains, the family is the basic building block of society, we know that it is under attack. We understand that this is Satan's world, this is his society, and he works feverishly against anything that comes from God. And the most fundamental and basic teaching of God has to do with family. So it's not a surprise that Satan is doing his best to upset, to change, and to cause difficulties in families. There have been changes in attitudes over the decades. Attitudes toward marriage, toward lifestyle choices that affect marriage and family. And those changes are having quite an impact. According to the Pew Research Foundation, I'll quote from their study. It says, the American family is changing in many ways. Cohabitation is on the rise. More adults are delaying or foregoing marriage. A growing share of children are living without, are living with an unmarried parent. And same-sex marriage is legal in all 50 states. That's a description that would have been maybe unthinkable just a few decades ago. Cohabitation, of course, means unmarried couples living together as husband and wife. In the past, this was rare and not looked upon with favor, but now it is common. Some years ago, I took a class which was intended to teach me how to use a tool we have called Prepare Enrich, and it's to help young couples prepare for marriage. It's one of the goals of this program. So they had a seminar to which they invited ministers from various churches from all over the metropolitan area to come to a location, and they gave us this orientation class on the program. One thing that I found really surprising, and this goes back 15 years since this happened, was that there was a discussion in this orientation for preparing for marriage counseling, and in it, it became clear that everyone else in that room, there must have been about 15 of us, all the rest of the pastors in that room had members in their congregation who were not married, who were living together. And they all felt that was just fine. And these were ministers in some of the local Protestant congregations. And they felt that it was just fine, and that the preparation for marriage could be used even just to help couples who are living together so that they could have a good and happy relationship. Obviously, that's not something that we recognize as being acceptable at all. In 2016, 15%, that's 21 million, births were to unmarried women. 15%. 21 million children born to women who were not married. Many of those, of course, were teenagers, still children themselves. The attitude toward, again, those kinds of births has changed and it's become acceptable. And many high schools actually have daycare centers where these girls can drop off their little babies and then go to their junior year history class or whatever, and it's almost normal. Same-sex marriage, of course, is in contradiction to everything God said about marriage in Genesis 2. It has no place in God's plan for families or for marriage. The research continued saying that with these changes, it says that 3 in 10, 30% of U.S. adults think these changes are a good thing. Almost a third felt that these changes are good. Only half that many, about 16%, felt that these changes were bad, were not a good thing. And most of the rest, 45%, said, doesn't matter one way or the other. So I put them in the same category as those who approve of it, meaning that well over three quarters of people surveyed in this research agreed with or accepted the changes that were being made. Certainly, families under attack, and this is the society that our children are growing up in. Divorce is also a threat to the family. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, during a first marriage, those who are married for the first time, both members of the couple marrying for the first time, there's a 20% chance that that marriage will end in divorce within 5 years. And there's a 33% chance it will end within 10 years. So the commitment is not there. The understanding of the importance of the relationship is certainly not there. There are 2,400 divorces every day in the United States. 2,400 divorces every day. And I found this especially interesting. Since the coronavirus outbreak in March of this year, there's been a 34% increase in divorces compared to 2019. Apparently, the stress and the difficulties, maybe being confined in the home, isolated together, whatever is causing the problems to come to the surface. And there's an increase of more than one-third in divorces in this period of time compared to last year. These statistics and these opinions, these trends, of course, are very much a concern to us. And we certainly want our marriages, our families, and our children to live in a very different kind of a situation. So we look to God's Word for instruction about marriage and family. The church itself has a booklet on the subject called God's Design for Marriage. And there are several articles on Life Open Truth that relate to marriage and how to have a marriage that is successful in God's eyes, and where we can have a stable family. You know, marriage and family are built into our personal lives. It's just natural to all of us. It is the way that life works. It's ordinary. It's part of a cycle or a pattern. Most young people tend to naturally desire to have a relationship that leads to marriage. It's just the way things are. But here's the problem. Just because it is so familiar, just because it seems natural to most, it doesn't mean that people know automatically how to be married. It's easy to get married. It's not usually difficult to find someone that people pair up and they decide they want to be married. But just because they do so doesn't mean they know how to be married. Certainly doesn't guarantee that they know how to train or care for their children. Like anything else, this is something that we need to learn. We need to understand principles that can be applied. These are things that we need to know in our relationships and incorporate into our relationships. Here's a quote, just a sentence from the introduction to our booklet, God's Design for Marriage. Here's our understanding. It says, "The institution of marriage was created by God as a profound gift to mankind. It was designed by our Creator to be an oasis of intimacy, stability, and love for adults and for the children who come through or are born in that special relationship." It's something that God created, and in doing so, He established how marriages and how families are supposed to work. We also have on our members' website a study paper. It's entitled Divorce and Remarriage, Statement of Belief. Now, we're not going to get into the serious complications in marriage that might lead to a divorce. If you would like to research that paper, you can find it on our members' website. But I want to make a point that is included in the introduction to this paper. Here's what the statement is in one of the opening paragraphs. It says, "The church maintains the biblical teaching of the sanctity and lifetime commitment of marriage and encourages counseling as part of an effort to resolve problems within a marriage." The reason I emphasize that statement is that in spite of everything going on in society, we understand clearly that the church believes in the sanctity and the lifetime commitment of marriage. And even though this particular study paper is about how to deal with, within the church, the issues of divorce and remarriage, our fundamental teaching, our commitment, is to the commitment of marriage for life. And if there is an issue that becomes a problem within a marriage, then we encourage counseling to help resolve those problems. And I'll add one more note to that. It is also a policy within the Kagwa ministry that counseling is required before we will perform a wedding. If a couple comes and would like to be married, that's exciting, that's good, that's something that we encourage in the right circumstances, but counseling is required before a marriage will be performed. By the way, that's not just something that the church has made up, that somehow we're being controlling or dominating our young people in some unmerited way. This is a policy that even many counties have and states. If a young couple goes to buy a marriage license, often before they will be given that marriage license, they're required to take a class that is offered by the state or by the county to help them to be prepared for marriage. I'm not sure just exactly what their approach is, but there's an interest even on that level of reducing the number of broken families and broken marriages, because it has quite an impact on society in general. So I'm trying to emphasize then the importance of the marriage relationship. And of course, from that comes the importance of the family relationship as well. Now, in one short sermon, I will not give you a complete set of answers to all the issues that could ever affect a family or a marriage. But I hope that we can at least provide an overview of some basic scriptural factors that do contribute to a successful and a pleasant family and marriage. So we'll begin looking in Scripture by going to a passage that you may not initially even consider to be anything to do with marriage. But as we look at the principles that are given here, we find that what Paul is writing about in Ephesians 4 applies to the marriage relationship, to the family relationship, really even more than it does to the general church relationship that he's specifically writing about. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 22. Now, we're breaking into the middle of a sentence here. Sometimes when you read Paul, it's hard not to do that. But we're breaking into the middle of a sentence in a context where Paul is talking about the conversion from an old way of life to a new way of life. And we pick it up here in mid-sentence. He says that you put off concerning your former conduct, the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. Let's take that thought and apply it to our families and our marriages. We all bring into a marriage our history and our experience. We all bring into this kind of a relationship some of the things that we grew up with that may or may not have been proper examples and teaching for us. There are things that we bring into our relationships that need to be set aside, that need to be overcome, that will not be a healthy part of a new marriage or family relationship. It's part of the conversion process. Not everybody grew up in the perfect household. Some people grew up in very dysfunctional families that were even dangerous. But wherever you grew up, for you, that was normal. That's the way you came to view life. Now, maybe you come into a marriage relationship and you don't want to repeat the mistakes that were made in your family, but you still bring those experiences and that history with you. So as part of the new man, as opposed to the old man, is to put off some of those things that we would need to, that have been a part of our lives in the past. Verse 23, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which is created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. Our approach to a marriage and a family should be based on godly standards that we are learning as we go through our own personal repentance and conversion process. Verse 25, we're going to skip down through some of this. Some of it is really not related directly to marriage. Verse 25 says we put off lying. Of course, marriages should be based on honesty. But I want to drop down to verse 26. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Of course, it's applicable, as Paul specifically is writing here, to the church and their relationships. But consider it in the light of a family and a marriage. Anger should not be a central part of our relationship at all. Don't let the sun go down on it. Some people take that very literally. I don't have any problem with taking it literally. But the point is, don't let it fester. Don't let anger continue and to develop. Because if we do that, then it opens the door to Satan. Satan is an angry being who wants us to be angry, who wants us to be agitated and stirred up. And he certainly would delight in agitating and stirring up a marriage. So be conscious and aware that we need to be sure to control and not let anger become a part of our relationship. In many times I've counseled with couples who tell me about instances, things that took place in their marriage 30 years ago, and they're still upset. They're still angry at each other for something that happened so long ago, sometimes even longer ago than that. That's not the principle of not letting the sun go down on your wrath. Some people store it up. Some people save it up so they can use it against one another in the next go-round. So this principle of not letting anger become a dominant part of your life applies obviously and clearly to our marriages and our families. This kind of anger could affect the relationship with children as well. Verse 29, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth. The word corrupt means something that is worthless, something that is harmful, something that is vulgar. Again, sometimes if anger is part of a relationship, things are said that are just mean and ugly. And this becomes a problem. It adds to the issues in a situation, in a marriage problem. But instead, speak what is good for necessary edification. You know, the focus of our relationship should not be on being angry or hurting one another, but of building up and of growing and helping each other to make the progress that we support them in. Verse 31, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you, along with all malice. Again, obviously, Paul is writing to the church and their church relationships. But I'll make the point once again. It applies just as much, in fact, more immediately and more importantly in the context of our personal lives, in our families and in our marriages, not to let this kind of environment grow. But be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. Sometimes it's easy to be a little bit harsh or a little bit tough on people who we're closest to. But if the emphasis is on being kind and tender-hearted and forgiving, then that creates a whole different environment in a marriage and in a family. Forgiving is of particular importance. You see, if we have that approach in our relationships, then we're not going to store up anger over things that happened in the past. They need to be resolved, and we need to be able to move forward from those circumstances. And so they're very basic, very fundamental, but very important in our connection with one another. There's nothing complicated or new about the need to relate in this way, but I'm pointing the focus, or making the focus here apply to the way we treat one another in our marriage and in our families. Another very basic principle is that effective communication is essential. Effective communication is essential. We've already touched on that, of course, talking about not being angry and not using corrupt language and being forgiving and so on. So we'll expand on that thought just a little bit. Effective communication is absolutely essential in marriage and in family. Whenever I've worked to help a couple in their marriage, communication is almost always an issue. One or the other feels that the other is not a good communicator, and that causes difficulties and issues. But communication is very basic to us. We communicate all the time, but do we do so in an effective way? Do we do it effectively in our marriages and in our families? Oftentimes what we communicate is that we're not pleased. We can do that either verbally or non-verbally. Communication should be, again, effective and positive in order to strengthen a marriage and strengthen a family. It takes a lot of patience. One issue with communication is that people don't often want to take the time that it really takes to fully and properly communicate. Sometimes we run into the difference, okay, well, there's men are different from women, and women like to communicate more than men do, and so we've got this barrier. Well, there is a difference. But at the same time, we can learn and practice the skills of communication so that even those who are maybe least experienced or comfortable doing so can learn to communicate effectively in their marriage. Let's look at another verse that we use in a general sense so often, but let's apply it to our marriage relationship. James chapter 1. James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. This is a basic principle in any relationship, but I will say especially in the marriage, in the family. James 1, verse 19. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man, every person, be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. There will be situations where we need to slow things down. When there are issues and the anger begins to grow, sometimes people will begin to say things that aren't relevant or that aren't helpful, and tempers rise and it becomes difficult to communicate, even impossible. We need to be able to slow things down. Swift to hear. Listening is probably the most important aspect of communication. We think that we need to be able to argue effectively or to convince someone of our position. There may be a time when that is going to be necessary. But what's most important first is to listen. If we listen to another person's concern, then we can begin to understand it. You know, we read in our men's club last year or year before the book by Stephen Covey, on the 7 habits of highly effective people. And one of the habits that he emphasized comes straight from this passage. The title he gave to the chapter in the book was "Seek First to Understand, Then to Be Understood." The first thing we need to do is listen, to be swift to hear. There's an exercise that some of the marriage counseling books suggest, and I think it can be helpful, at least as to help people learn to communicate better. They call it active listening. And what happens with active listening is one person is allowed to speak and the other is required to sit quietly and only listen until the first person has finished what they want to say. It's not like a presidential debate. You don't interrupt each other. You let the person say fully what they want to say. And then before you even respond, you repeat back what you heard that person say. That forces you to be listening and to be thinking about what you're hearing, not thinking about what you're going to respond. So you listen carefully and respond. Summarize, first of all, what the person said in their statement so that they know you understand what they said. And if you don't have it right, then they have the right to say, no, that's not what I said, and explain further until you finally understand. That is the key, to understand. And then, slow to speak. Even when a person has responded and shown that he understands what the other has said, words in response should be chosen very carefully. To be slow to speak. Part of the problem we have in communication is making rash statements without giving a lot of thought to what we're saying. Listen carefully. Understand first what has been said. And then, in your response, choose your words very carefully. And as we saw in Ephesians, a principle is that we choose words that will edify, that will build, not words that will be hurtful to the other. It sounds a bit mechanical. It sounds maybe a bit difficult to try to apply in real-life situations. But the principles are there to consider. And as you look at circumstances in your life, in your family, in your marriage, you'll find that there are times when this is a very effective and really a simple approach. It's just understanding it is not difficult, but following it can be. Slow to speak, choosing our words carefully and thoughtfully. And finally, slow to wrath. It is amazing, isn't it, how quickly we can go from zero to angry. It just doesn't take but a moment to set things off. Slow to wrath. Now, if we read it carefully, maybe there's a time for wrath. But let's not rush to that conclusion, but rather be thoughtful and understanding and not angered easily. And we go back to some of the statements that Paul made in Ephesians 4 about not holding our anger, not becoming an angry person. Here's the point, though, that is made. The whole point is made in verse 20. Because, look, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. no matter how right we may be, we're wrong if we take an angry approach. If we take a quick approach without listening and understanding. This is the way people respond, and it is not going to work. It never works. But this formula that James outlines here can work. It has to take some practice. We have to learn to apply it, but it is a very effective way to resolve conflict or differences in families. And I'm not suggesting that it's all going to be solved at the moment, right on the spot. There are some things, some areas in our life that's going to take some time to fully understand and resolve. But this formula at least prevents a couple or in a family situation from going, again, from zero to anger and get, you know, pegging the needle on anger and not being able to bring it under control. Swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Turn back to Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs 15. Verse 4. Proverbs 15, verse 4. This is really another way of saying what we've been talking about. Proverbs 15, verse 4. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. Words can be devastating. Words are sometimes used as a weapon, intentionally meant to inflict harm or to hurt another. But words can also be a tree of life. Words can restore. Words can calm. Words can express understanding and love, even in what otherwise might be a tense situation. A wholesome tongue. One is not a corrupt tongue, as we again came across in Ephesians 4. Similar statement, actually a little different wording, different emphasis in chapter 16, verse 24. Proverbs 16, 24. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. Words fitly spoken, as it says in another proverb, are going to have a very different result. Pleasant words are like honeycomb. I don't eat a lot of honeycomb, but I'm sure that it's sweet. It might be more meaningful to me to rephrase it a bit. Pleasant words are like M&Ms. Nice big handful of peanut M&Ms would be a very pleasant thing to me, very sweet. I'm not sure they would get health to my bones. But it's, the point is that words that are carefully chosen heal. And they bring about a different environment. It changes everything. You know, a soft answer turns away wrath, it says in another proverb. The words that we choose, the way that we communicate, is certainly a very meaningful and very important way. Now, again, I'm speaking in some general terms, and I'm not trying to suggest that if you just have one friendly conversation or try one time that everything's going to be solved if you have some issues. But these are the principles of communication that are scriptural and that do work when they are applied in our relationships. Something else to consider, and to some of the things that we have to deal with that are realistic, the stress of life will challenge every marriage. The stress of life will challenge every marriage and family. Life simply is stressful. Life brings about situations and circumstances that make us edgy. And when we feel edgy and stressed, sometimes we're not going to be the most pleasant people. We have to understand and be ready to deal with, to accept the fact that life is stressful. In the Kagwa wedding ceremony, the couple promises before God to remain together, and I'll quote, in sickness and in health, in good times and difficult times, for as long as you both shall live. As we said at the beginning, quoting from the doctrinal paper, marriage is a lifetime commitment. But lifetime has its bumps. Lifetime has its challenges and its stress. And that stress can either strengthen a relationship as a couple works together, or it can pull them apart. I mentioned earlier the increase in divorces just since the coronavirus began. I think, to some extent at least, that has to do with the stress of life. Maybe there's financial stress. Maybe there's a personal stress. Maybe there's family members that have been lost or have been sick. It creates all kinds of stressors in our lives. And we need to recognize that, yeah, that's part of what we signed up for. It's going to happen. And we need to be willing to deal with that. There's grief, there's loss, there's pain. There are things that are very challenging for us. And our marriages, though, and families are to continue through those difficult times. I want to make one more just general comment or principle. Marriages and families must be built on godly values and convictions. Marriages and families must be built on godly values and convictions. You know, everyone has values. Everyone has things in their lives that are important to them that they would stress, that they're convicted of and committed to. The point is that a successful marriage and family must be built on godly values and convictions. We develop convictions, and our values are based on God's word and on God's instruction. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. There's some strong language here that is sometimes difficult for people to accept. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. I'll just read verse 14. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Don't be drawn into a commitment that puts you at some sort of obligation or some form of weakness with others where they have some domination in the relationship if they're an unbeliever. That's pretty hard to do. Sometimes. Don't be unequally yoked. Don't be tied together with one who is not sharing the same values and convictions that you hold. This, I realize, is a particular challenge for our teens and young adults. It is not easy in this age and in this church to find others who hold the same values that you do and have the same convictions that you have. And so what sometimes happens is that young people meet someone who's not a believer, who doesn't share the same values and convictions. They are drawn together by personality. There are a lot of things that they enjoy about each other. They enjoy spending time together. They seem very compatible on this level of personality. But a basic and important component is to be spiritually compatible. It makes a world of difference when a family shares the same understanding, values, and commitment. And again, I recognize that some feel like they're in kind of a waiting mode, have not been able to establish that kind of a relationship with someone who does have the same values. But I've been talking with members whose spouses are not in the church. Spouses, maybe they came into the church after they were married and their spouse was not called. So now they have an imbalance in their relationship. Sometimes they can work it out. Often they can. 1 Corinthians 7 says that you should not divorce your spouse just because they're an unbeliever. Again, that's talking about a situation where after marriage, one becomes a believer, one becomes part of the church. So if there's that situation, it can be worked out, but the point would be, why put yourself in that situation? Why create that stress for the relationship? So it's a consideration that needs to be part of the thought process in being with those that we enjoy. The most important part of compatibility is going to be a spiritual and godly compatibility. Some people have said, well, yeah, look, but look at all these marriages between church members that end in divorce. And so they might use that as a reason why it doesn't matter if you marry within the faith. So, okay, we can look at that. It does happen. But let's consider this. Marriage doesn't fail. People fail. Marriage is, again, the institution that God created, and it will not fail. But people sometimes do. And so we make choices. We must establish and then maintain godly values and convictions. Ephesians chapter 5 gives us another glimpse at some values that are important to us as Christians. Ephesians chapter 5. Let's look first at verse 25. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. It's drawing a very deep spiritual analogy. Jesus Christ, pictured as a husband in this case, has dedicated himself to the church. And so the principle that Paul is emphasizing is that husbands should be just as dedicated, just as loving, just as concerned for their wives as Christ is for the church. And when we as husbands have that kind of an attitude of service in our marriage relationships, then it is going to help to establish the right kind of environment that we're looking for in our marriage and in our family. If a wife feels secure, if a wife feels that she's understood and loved and cared for, that makes a huge difference in the connection that a husband and a wife share. A challenge, of course, is to maintain that over a period of time. life goes along, we settle into patterns, we settle into ways that we live our lives from day to day and week to week, and sometimes just kind of get into a pattern, or I'll even call it a rut. We just live in a certain way, and we don't consider, again, the love and the emotion that drew us together, and that we just kind of begin to take things for granted or not focus on them as much as would be necessary. Jesus Christ doesn't ever not care for his church. He doesn't get distracted by other things. So husbands are commanded in this verse to properly love, care for, take care of, and serve their wives. This is something we grow in. It's not something we automatically know how to do. It's something we practice. It's something that develop, is this kind of love for our wives. Now let's back up to verse 22. Wives, submit to your own husbands. One general important thought here is it does not say, women, submit yourselves to all men. It says there's a special relationship between a wife and her husband. And the wife is to submit to her own husband as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. This is a statement that many in this world would just absolutely bristle at and reject. It sounds sexist. It sounds like a male-dominated world. And it just doesn't fit with the way that many people think today. But there is a principle here that is important for a husband and wife to grow in. I will take this back to communication. As a husband and wife, how are you going to manage your marriage and your family? How are you going to consider the scriptural instructions about leadership and submission? What does that mean to you? How are you going to grow in and learn how to apply that to your decisions and to the lives that you lead? There's a lot of room in that general instruction for marriages, for husbands and wives to work out their relationship. Don't flip it over and turn it around and contradict this very clear instruction, but work within it to understand and share together how you will apply these principles. I don't know that I could stand up here and tell you how all wives should submit to their husbands. I wouldn't want to put myself in that kind of a jeopardy of thinking that I could do that. But you, in your relationship, can work together to understand that and to apply it. What does it mean for the husband to be the head of the family? Well, there are some decisions, perhaps. There are some ways that we can consider specifically, but you consider it and you build your marriage on these biblical principles and grow in them. There is a place in marriage that's very important for genuine respect and consideration. You know, it says earlier in this same context, verse 21, we all submit to one another. And again, that's talking to the church, but I think we can also apply that principle in our marriage. There's a structure, there's an organization that is God-ordained, and it's how a marriage is to work. Again, let's not fight against that basic foundational principle, but you can work within your marriage to establish how that works for you. Now, there's nothing in this instruction from Paul that in any way diminishes the role of the wife in the marriage. Again, I think sometimes people misunderstand it or take it that way. There's nothing in here that diminishes the importance or the role of a wife. Turn to Proverbs chapter 14. Proverbs 14, verse 1. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 1. The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish pulls it down with her hands. The success of a marriage and a family is just as much upon the wife as the husband. A wise woman builds her house, establishes, strengthens her household and her family. A foolish woman pulls it down by decisions, by behavior, however. But it takes wisdom for a woman to contribute her part to the family and the marriage to build that household. My parents have both died. My father died in 2010. My mother died in 2017. Over the years, my brothers and I have gotten together on many occasions, and we always enjoy going back and talking about some of our shared and different memories of growing up in kind of a interesting, sometimes chaotic household. But there's one thing that all six of us have always fully agreed on. That is that our mother was the rock in our family. She was the one who held us together. Now, I'm not saying anything against my dad. He was a fine man, a good husband, a loving father. But there was something special about the relationship that we each had with Mom. She was the one we could more easily go to, talk to. She had a different style of communication. Now, she wasn't easy. She was tough. She could be hard. But there was a special connection that every one of us had with Mom. She built her house. Again, my father, fine man, Christian, good husband. We knew that he loved us and he would do anything for us. But there's a special connection between us, and I think in many other cases, with our mom. You know, there are a lot of other things we could talk about marriage, and I'm already out of time. Go back and read Deuteronomy 6, verses 7 and 8. It's a very fundamental passage. It has to do with parents working together to model and teach godly standards to their children. To show your children by the way you live what a Christian is. This is how a Christian handles all these different situations. Some of them fun and easy, some of them difficult and challenging, but this is what a Christian does. That's what we as parents are responsible for in working with our marriages, working with our family. It's how a marriage can work. A very basic principle. Let's conclude in Proverbs chapter 18. Proverbs chapter 18. This is one of those verses that just kind of shows one side, but I think both sides are implied. Proverbs 18, verse 22 says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord." 48 years ago, I was blessed with my wife, and it's been a good thing. Good things have come. Good things have happened. And my life would not have been what it is without that blessing that God gave to me. I hope that she could kind of turn this proverb around and say the same thing, that she who finds a husband finds a good thing. I think it's implied in the proverb itself because it takes both of us to establish and build a marriage and a family. And it is indeed a tremendous blessing when we find our spouse, our soul mate. We obtain favor from God. God chooses to bless us in a very special way through the spouse, the husband, the wife that he provides for us. We live in a world where families are coming undone, but that world should not touch our families. It doesn't have to. Our family should be a tremendous blessing, a primary source of security and joy, and it can be. It begins when a couple finds each other, and God grants that favor, that blessing. And usually it leads to the next generation, to children. In Psalm 127, verse 3, it says, children are a heritage from God. In that cycle of love, of marriage, and family continues from one generation to the next. There's much more to be said, much more to be learned, much more you can study and read and consider and talk over with your husband, with your wife. But it's very important for us to remember that marriage works. Marriage works. And it's based on the principle of some of the principles that we have discussed here this afternoon. And in following those principles, God can bless us with a happy, successful, and blessed marriage and family.